If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
Being influenced by outside ideas and thought, and for me to have worked in the 90s in Saint-Emilion in the right bank and being able to see so much of the ideas that were so important to wine and would become so important to wine was something that changed my life.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 466. This week we feature Corey Turnbull, owner and winemaker at Burning Tree Cellars in Arizona. We continue our series of Arizona winery interviews this week with Corey Turnbull, owner and winemaker at Burning Tree Cellars. Corey also makes wine for a much larger winery in town, but this 1,000-case winery is his true passion project. Our search for interesting and diverse wines continues, and we hope you enjoy the ride. Let us know by sending an email to ray@lifebetweenthevines.com. You can also listen to Corey on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term GARF. So we're back to Arizona today, which is great. We are talking to Corey Turnbull of Burning Tree Cellars today in Arizona. How you doing, Corey?
Doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm good. I have to ask probably the one obvious question, and when I messed up our intro, the name Turnbull, I, of course, immediately think of the winery in Napa. Is there any association there at all?
No, I tried getting free wine there once. It didn't work.
Yeah, I tried that with a French wine with my last name. They kind of laughed at me as well.
Yeah.
It was just kind of, it's always funny to me. Sometimes these names have a little intermarriage to them in the business, and there's always that assumption, oh, you must be so-and-so.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, I've actually gotten, you know, I was waiting 3 years to get some Mary-U barrels about 5 years ago, and I think I got bumped up the list because I thought I worked for Turnbull.
Sure. That's not a bad thing. Use it when you can.
That's right, I did.
Yeah. Good for you. So you are the owner and you're a partner, I believe, at Turning... Oh, my God. Try it again.
Burning Tree.
Turning Brie. Thank you very much.
Turning Brie.
Yeah, it's totally different.
Funny, that's my assistant winemaker's name.
Is it really?
Yeah, Brie, yeah.
It's the whole connection there. It's a cheese thing.
It's weird.
Yeah, it is. So you are a partner as well as the winemaker at Burning Tree, and you also have another different kind of gig as winemaker, right?
Yeah, much larger winery, kind of where we started. I mean, that's one of the first wineries here in the Verde Valley and the state. It's definitely one of the largest, too. It's called Page Springs Cellars, and I kind of make my Burning Tree wines here, which are, you know, more of a smaller, only 1,000 case to 1,500 cases a year, all small batch stuff, whereas Page Springs, we do about a little over 8,500 cases a year.
Yeah, definitely a big difference. What year did you start Burning Tree?
2007 was my first vintage, although it sat in barrel for a couple years. 2009 we released, it was only 3 barrels of red blend. And then we didn't open the tasting room till 2012, but technically, we incorporated in 2009. First wine was 2007 vintage.
So you've been around for a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been, well, you know, I used to come down and be in a past life, I tell people, because it seems so long ago. I worked in the restaurant business, and I was a kind of a base level sommelier, I'd buy wine, really into wine. That's kind of where I met Eric Glomsky, who owns Page Springs, and started coming out here and working for free, and back in 2005, just working harvest, and then kind of worked my way up, left that business, worn a lot of hats over the years in the wine industry here, and seen it grow from, you know, nothing to where we are today.
The wine business is one of the very few businesses that it's not too hard to get people to work for free, right?
It's true. Well, I got the thief a barrel. That was my payment every day. It was like thief a barrel.
Oh, that's not bad. Yeah.
So, not technically free, but they definitely got the better end of the deal.
Yeah. Well, that's usually how it works out when it comes to labor.
Sure.
So your personal wine journey, you know, obviously you said you came from the restaurant business, and that did you have the aha moment? I'm sure you've been asked this question a million times, but how did you get into wine?
Oh, you know, I was young. I even in high school, I was bringing bottles of Chianti Classico and stuff to parties instead of kegs. I got into it back. I started working in restaurants when I was 13. So here in the Verde Valley, you know, and a lot of our kind of industry is driven by tourism or construction. Those are the two things you can really get into when you're young. So either you're digging ditches or you're, you know, bussing tables. And I went with the latter, which seemed a little bit better for me at the time. But there's a guy named Joe Mooney who was a waiter at a restaurant called Steak and Sticks that I used to bus tables for. And this was years and years ago. And there was a weird situation where this couple came in and they ordered a bottle of champagne off the list. And, you know, I knew what the wines were, but I was kind of ignorant. I was only 16 years old or 15. And they asked if we had any champagne. I just went for the most expensive one on the list. It was a 1989 Cristal from Roeder. And they ordered it, and it was really weird. Looking back on it, I think she might have been a prostitute and him like an older professor, because it was just a really weird situation. She was half his age, and they dropped Marciano cherries in their single glasses of Cristal, and they drank half those glasses, and then they left.
Hey.
This was the end of the night, and Joe gave me a little extra money to kind of clean up so he can get out of there early. I was cleaning up, and I lifted up that bucket of champagne, and it was really heavy. So I took it to the back, and it was about two-thirds of a bottle full of Cristal, which I didn't turn in. I just dumped it into a large styrofoam cup and proceeded to drink it while I was mopping. And I think that's kind of where that could have been an aha moment for me, where I just love champagne, and champagne was kind of my first love in the wine thing, and then it turned into reds, and, you know, now it's all kinds of stuff.
That must have been a very long mopping job, is my guess.
Yeah. Although, I don't know, I was pretty energized, so I probably got through it pretty quick. Yeah, it was definitely a worthy, I'll stick around for bottles of Cristal any day, even at 42, not 15.
Yeah, I totally get that. It's interesting, you know, to go down this path to become a winemaker, because it's a much more serious commitment when you get to that point, because there's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. It's not just the idea of enjoying wine.
Sure.
It's being very integral. How did that feel? I mean, was that something really, was it that passion?
For me, it wasn't. I mean, for me, it's really, you know, I've gotten here with a lot of hard work, a lot of sacrifice, but also a little bit of luck, too. And my first started kind of in the cellar full time over at our sister winery, Arizona Stronghold Vineyard. And there was a vacuum there of kind of leadership. The winemaker and assistant winemaker kind of left, and they put together this kind of ragtag crew. And it was just an opportunity for me to step up. And there was a lot of things with, you know, really what winemaking's about, and, you know, trying to understand problems with plumbing and electrical problems and, you know, floor drain issues and steamers breaking and, you know, understanding the bottling line and lubrication and replacing parts and all that stuff. So I jumped into that headstrong and kind of proved myself over there. And I don't know, it's always been hard work for me, but at the same time, it's never really been much work at all. Kind of, I love being here, and I think you kind of have to have that kind of gung-ho, love this attitude, otherwise you get burnt out pretty quick.
Yeah, I would agree. It's like being a chef. It's kind of funny, you're talking about options, you know, working in a restaurant or construction, and I guess in a way you got your taste of construction, because this is the non-sexy part of being a winemaker, all these important details that have to be done, like owning any business, right?
Correct. Yeah, the whole romantic side of winemaking is a very, very minimal part of it. Most of it's, you know, there's an internal joke. We say that, you know, winemaking is about 70% moving heavy things and another 25% cleaning stuff. And then you got 5% to drink beer and pontificate.
Yeah, lots of beer, as they say.
Yeah. Sure.
So let's talk about the Verde Valley, and now it's the newest AVA. I believe you have three AVAs in Arizona, correct?
Well, I know Wilcox and the Verde Valley. I don't know. I guess Sonoyta would be the third. Elgin would possibly be the third, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I believe it is. I'll have to double-check my facts on that. So a new AVA, obviously this kind of thing doesn't happen overnight anywhere in this country. There's a lot of work that goes into that. What makes the Verde Valley unique?
I think it's kind of like a sub, the same reason why Arizona in general is unique. There's a lot of different acclimations to the sun. There's different soil compositions. People grow a lot of different, you know, varietals, and I think that's true for Arizona as a whole. It's the wines from up here are unique. I mean, like, I could talk about our vineyards that are sitting on, like, we have 10 acres that are on the western flank of a dormant shield volcano. It's been dormant for millions of years, but it's all volcanic topsoil and super rich wines coming from that site. And then just a stone's throw away on the opposite bank of Oak Creek, we have another site that's completely different, has some volcanic topsoil because of the volcano blown its top millions of years ago, but underneath it's all pretty deep limestone. Because the Verde Valley formation used to be a huge lake bed here, so there's a lot of limestone and in the soils. I don't know. I like Arizona wines. They're unique. We have to grow at elevation just because we're a little bit further south, and we get a lot of sunlight. So we grow anywhere between 3,500 and 5,000 feet, and so really big diurnal shifts. We retain a lot of acid in the wines because of the cooler nights. We get good flavors because of the warmer days. And the wines have a freshness to them, and they play well with food. And they're just definitely different.
As far as your varietals, you're growing a lot of different wines there, which really surprised me because I have to confess I wasn't very familiar with until I started doing a little research with Arizona wines, far more than I would have expected.
Yeah, it's our harvest runs, you know, most people's harvest might run 3 to 4 weeks. We're usually running sometimes up to 3 months.
Wow.
So, okay, we're always bringing in so much different wines. I mean, I have 136 different lots right now in the cellar just from this last vintage, and a lot of them are, you know, the majority of what we do is very small batch. You know, we might produce 8,400 cases, but of that, you know, we have some bigger blends that kind of make it to market. Everything else is just sold direct to consumer here. We don't really have a huge market presence. Page Springs does. Burning Tree has practically zero. Only I sell out of the tasting room, but, you know, 2 barrels of this, 4 barrels of that. I'm a little more traditional at Burning Tree. Like, I have the traditional Vinifera, you know, Syrah, Grenache. I focus on the Rhone a lot for Burning Tree. But at Page Springs, like, it's insane the different stuff that we do. And it's fun because, you know, I get to learn about a lot of these varietals, and, you know, you don't every day get to make, you know, like Montepulciano's and Aaron Arnoa's and Marcellon's and, you know, all these weird different varietals. But that's what's kind of fun about Arizona, and that's kind of what Arizona's about, is its diversity.
Well, and that's one thing I say constantly, and you guys are really basically mad scientists. I mean, you get to experiment, and you do get to find out some things good, some things not so good with some of these grapes.
Yeah. Yeah, and being the pioneers too, and it's, you know, we take the biggest financial risk too. We've you know, we've replanted several sites multiple times to find the right varietal, and it's kind of like the Wild West out here. You know, everyone's like, "Oh, I like Riesling. I want to plant Riesling," and you know, knowing what we know, we'd be like, "I wouldn't," you know. But you know, we grow all kinds of stuff, and I think it's kind of defined by our, you know, diversity in our growing areas. I mean, there's whether it be Wilcox or Sonoyta, or, you know, we have a vineyard over on the east side of the Chiricahuas that is an oddball, but it makes some of the best wines in the state. It's all rhyolitic granite, and it's actually north-facing. It's at 5,200 feet in elevation. It's in a canyon. It's always windy. But I think it makes some of the most interesting wines in our state. And it's called Calibri Vineyard, and that's what's cool about Arizona. There's always some exciting new, or at least it never gets boring. not so repetitive. Like if I had to make wine in Oregon and it was all Pinot and a little Pinot Gris, I don't know what I'd do with myself. I'd probably have more time off, but
yeah, there you go.
I'd be a little more bored.
Yeah, well, that would be a drag. You don't want to be a boring winemaker.
Yeah.
For post-prohibition, do you know roughly what the age of the Arizona wine industry, how far it goes back?
Pre-prohibition, there was vines here going back quite a ways. But post-prohibition, I want to say, I mean, there was actually a little vineyard in near Sedona called the Sherman Vineyard, and that guy was making wine and kind of selling it and bootlegging it in the during Prohibition, like right before and during Prohibition. But that was in like the 20s. But anyway, post-Prohibition, I want to say 1970s, early 70s, Gordon Dutt planted down in near Wilcox. It was kind of an experimental thing, and that kind of was the resurgence. And then Ken Callaghan came along, and, you know, he's a great winemaker, and he's done some great stuff down in Sonoyta. I think, you know, those two are the early pioneers. I mean, Dutt especially, and then Al Buell over in Wilcox as well planted a bunch of stuff. But, yeah, it's even now, I mean, it's still, you know, we're still the proverbial toddler banging their head on the coffee table. We're really small.
Well, everybody has to come from somewhere, right? I mean.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys get into sparkling at all?
You know, some people are doing, like, not traditional method champenois, you know, with Ritalin and
sure.
all that stuff. Some people are putting little things in there to, you know, like almost like pet gnats and things like that. We actually just brought a bright tank this year because we're making some piquettes. I don't know if you know if you're familiar with a piquette, but it's basically repurposed. So we'll bring in like a white wine or a rosé, and we'll do a cold soak if it's a rosé. We'll destem it and cold soak it, or we'll destem the white because we don't want to let a seed tan in or anything like that. And then we'll press it and get the juice out of there, you know, to tank like we do with a traditional rosé or white. But then we'll capture all the pomace and then add our spring water here and actually re-ferment it, and we get like a low alcohol, like, you know, 5-7% low alcohol wine, and then we basically put it in a bright tank and carbonate it like a beer, and it comes with a crown cap, and it's really like refreshing. It's almost like, you know, I hate saying it, but it's like a White Claw, but actually good. You know,
yeah.
Actually, you know, we're doing it with like Gewürztraminers, and I have I have a Mavedra and two different Cunois and a Grenache, I think. Anyway, we're doing like four different piquettes and then some apple ciders. We're doing all kinds of crazy stuff here.
Yeah,
but no traditional sparkling. I just think the infrastructure to do that, you'd have to really only focus on that.
Yeah.
I think it's possible. I think, you know, if you look at Gruet right across the border in New Mexico, they're doing good traditional sparkling wines and very similar, you know, very similar climate that we have over here.
Sure. I'm guessing you're in the cellar from the sounds I'm hearing in the background.
Yeah, there's always something going on around here.
Yeah.
Right now, Bree's mixing up some things, and we're just topping and, you know, putting wines away for the year, finally.
Yeah, that's got to feel good. It's interesting that you have such a long harvest, because harvest is changing for everybody around the world. Is climate change having an effect on you in any way?
Oh yeah, more so the inconsistencies. You know, another thing about making wine in Arizona, you know, we need heat tolerant varietals because we do have pretty intense summers, and we also need varietals that are a little bit more loosely clustered because we have a lot of moisture in the form of monsoon. So most of our growing regions kind of lie between high and lower elevations, so we're kind of in between. So we get a lot of rainfall during the later harvest months, if you will, like August, early September, late July, and we see a lot of fungal issues, and that we've come a long way to mitigate these problems and to understand which varietals do best. A lot of canopy management work, but that being said, you know, some years we might have no rain now, whereas, you know, 10 years ago it might have been a little more consistent, but now it's like we might be 7 inches under average, or it might be 7 inches over average, like this last year. which pushed harvest back like 2 weeks because it kept raining and, you know, it would dry out and the bricks would drop. So it's just, you know, a lot more. And then once it happened, it was just like, all right, here you go. Here's harvest, and it comes quick and hard.
Yeah.
I think climate change is definitely playing a part. I mean, we're used to growing grapes kind of on the edge, you know, 100-degree weather and monsoons, and we, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, but one of our biggest problems was frost. We've had some pretty rough frost years. 2011, I remember losing, I think we lost about 50% of our crop that year.
Wow.
So a lot of people don't realize that, but, you know, we have a mild winter. The vines will come out of dormancy a little bit early, and they'll start pushing, and then we'll get some insane frost event in, like, you know, April or early May, and we'll just lose a bunch of fruit. And Arizona's weird. Although I think frost has been less of an issue. I think overall we're getting warmer, but the rain and just the – if anything, whatever climate change is doing, I think it's just giving us more uncertainty. It's like, who knows what the vintage is going to bring.
Yeah, that seems to be the general consensus on this. This is probably a little bit of a stranger question, but with all these challenges in the vineyard, what about critters? You know, as an example, in some parts of Napa Valley, I know people are dealing with wild pigs, which are a big deal. What about
sure.
you guys?
We had a little family of javelinas living in our Treminette this last year that we had to kick out of there, and they ate a bunch of fruit before we got them out. There's deer, there's javelina, there's all these different things. We don't see a lot of crazy bug vectors, but they're around, you know, skeletonizers, and we haven't seen a lot of sharpshooters or stuff like that.
That's
but, mostly deer, javelina. Down at our southern site, like Calibri, we see, like, Cudamundi, black bears, things like that that'll get in the fence and start screwing stuff up.
Yeah, they like fruit, don't they?
Yeah, so do I. So I can't really blame them.
No, can't blame them a bit.
Yeah.
Okay, now my stupid question. What is a javelina?
Javelina is basically, what's another word? Piccadilly, I think, is another word for it or something like that. It's basically it's like a big rat almost.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it looks like a pig. Looks like a wild pig. But I think the species is almost like some kind of rodent. I mean, I could be wrong there. Anyway, some people hunt them and... some people try to make sausage out of them, and those people are insane because they're just nasty, dirty animals.
Yeah. There are people who like to eat carp. I live near a Great Lake, so.
Yeah. Another thing that I would be like, you know, don't eat the bottom feeders.
Yeah, that's kind of my
thing. It's like mom telling you not to kill the yard bird. You know, just
yeah.
things I learned growing up I'm not
yes.
going to do. But that's me. I don't. So I've been offered javelina a bunch, and I always say, no thanks.
Yeah. There's some critters. I remember I was at a wine dinner once, and I had kangaroo, and it was pretty darn gamey. But that's a different subject. So
sure,
we don't
sure.
have to go there. As a winemaker, what's the most unusual advice you've ever been given?
Unusual.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I mean, I think every winemaker gets in there. They create their own style over time, you know, through what they learn, you know, from their mentor before them. And most winemakers have a mentor, and then you try to pass that information on. You change it and you tweak your stuff a little bit too, I think, as you go. And you know, you make mistakes, and that kind of defines your style. But pertaining to, like, weird advice that I've gotten from people,
yeah.
that's interesting. I mean, obviously, I've heard of things like people are like, oh, I don't SO2 at all until, you know, a month, you know, or I don't, yeah, like, purist winemakers that are really into natural wines that don't really pay attention to things that, you know, like acetobacters or, you know, Britannomyces or lactobacillus, all this other stuff that kind of makes the wine spoiled. Those guys crack me up because their wines are natural, but they're also nasty.
Well, and according to a lot of other winemakers, I would agree, wine is natural unto itself, right?
Well, it is. I just think you got to take care of it, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's just like anything. I look at my wine kind of like kids, you know? It's like you got to raise them and you got to make sure they're, you know, they're not covered in shit and you got to brush your teeth and, you know, in some sense, you know, at least.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, yeah. I totally agree. Well, you brought up mentor. Who is your mentor?
I'd say Eric Glomsky is probably my mentor. I've learned the most from him easily. He's the owner and, of, and his title is executive wine grower. But anyway, at Page Springs. And then, you know, I started my brand here under him, and I kind of fell in love with the whole business under him, you know, going on fruit trips and sitting in the middle of vineyards, you know, drinking Red Bull and, you know, getting ready for a pick, watch the sunrise and stuff like that. So, yeah, definitely Eric.
Cool. Are there other areas in the States that have impressed you? I mean, obviously, we have Willamette Valley and we have Napa, Sonoma, that kind of thing. But,
sure.
You know, one of the things I'm trying to do is get to as many states as I can and try these wines and talk about them. But for you, as a winemaker, where have you gone that has got your attention?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I'm a father, and I've been raising kids since I was 19. And my youngest is now as old as I was when I first had my first kid. And so mostly I've been staying at home, just working my ass off raising kids. But we've had some time to get away. We've been up to Oregon a couple times. We're going to Napa again for the third time, Napa Sonoma here in about a week and a half. I love Russian River wines. I love Santa Cruz Mountains like Cab and Pinot and Russian River, particularly coastal, like Bodega area, Pinot and Chardonnay. I've had a couple interesting wines from Idaho. I always think that's kind of a new, mm-hmm. like a new area that I would like to check out more. Had a couple interesting wines from Colorado. We actually made a Colorado Syrah here back in 2008 from the Grand River area over by Grand Junction, which I think there's promise there. You know, I try to drink everything. I'm really into, you know, European wines. I drink a lot of stuff from Alsace, and I love German Rieslings and Alsatian Gewurz and Pinot Gris and good Burgundies, always tasty, good Beaujolais, like Cru Beaujolais. I love Burgundy, but it's too expensive for me for the most part.
Yeah, join the club. Yeah.
Well, just for me, it's hard for me to take such a risk and spend so much money when some of it can be super bready or, you know, just weird. But yeah, I don't know. I drink wines from, I'm really into culty, you know, California stuff too, like Alvin and Sinequinon. I've been part of their membership for a while. I buy those wines. Still expensive, but I can sell them and make money, so it works.
Yeah, I get that. Well, my favorite question to ask winemakers is probably the most challenging one, and that is, for all the time you've done media and interviews, what is the one question that you've not been asked that you would like to be asked?
Well, that's a tough one. I don't know. These are good questions. I have no idea. Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know. I think we do so much crazy stuff here. It's like, you know, a lot of people don't understand the different things we do. Like, we do a lot of barrel ferments. We do a lot of batonnage, you know, stirring of whites post-harvest. We do, you know, like, we did 7 different rosés this year.
Wow.
You know, just in this little winery, we make about 80 different wines a year, plus 80 or so as an average.
You're a busy guy.
Yeah, well, we're just really super nerdy. we just like drinking different stuff, really, and we're really big foodies too. So for us, it's just to have more to paint with when we're pairing, you know. And we have a really, you know, big wine club here too. So I don't know. That's a tough question. I'm more of a patient person, and I'll just answer whatever's asked of me, but I never really thought of, like, what I want to be asked.
That's okay. It was a good answer, though. I'll use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll make
okay.
it.
Okay, sounds
yeah.
good.
Cool.
It qualifies.
Oh, yeah, it'll definitely qualify. Corey, this is fun talking to you, but more importantly, for our listeners who'd like to learn more about you and about Burning Tree Cellars, what is your website?
It's just burningtreecellars.com. Pretty simple.
Not very complicated.
No.
That's great. Well, I'm enjoying learning about Arizona wine. I look forward to tasting it sometime in the near future, and who knows, maybe we'll get to meet in person. But for the time being, thank you very much for taking the time, and I wish you guys great success.
All right, thanks for having me.
Learn more by visiting burningtreecellars.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2021.